Why do you use an actual microphone, whereas I'm using this thing?
I have one.
Hey, I have one too.
Then why aren't you using a mic? The question would be, why aren't you using a microphone? Bruce.
Hi, this is Doug Mann, and I am going to do this over again. Hi, this is Doug Mann, formerly of REX Music, or Muzak. And I am on as a guest on the podcast As the Story Grows.
What would you say you do here?
Have a good time all the time.
Who's got it better than us?
Nobody!
What in God's holy name are you blathering about?
Well, I'll tell you what I'm blathering about. I've got information, man.
I want you to be realistic.
What do you love about music?
Man being realistic.
As the story grows.
You got this, Travis. Make him wait for it. Boom.
Doug, do you know where the title for As the Story Grows comes from?
I haven't a clue, man.
Take it away, Bruce.
Travis.
One of you two are going to tell me, right?
I hope it's
Travis good. Knows. Travis named it. I mean, I do know, but I mean, I probably will botch it.
I lived in Denver, so I could probably come up with some ideas, but Travis, why don't you tell us?
Is it a lyric or a song title?
Song title.
A Scattered Few song title.
Scattered Few song.
Mm-hmm. Your old buddy Ronald. Alan.
Yep.
That's Spyglass Blue. Yeah, man.
Yep.
Absolutely.
Awesome.
Yeah. Nice.
Hey, Doug. Welcome back to the next chapter of As the Story Grows. My name's Trav.
Yeah.
We have with us Doug Mann, formerly of REX Music, and are we going to call a co-host, Bruce?
Guest host.
Whatever. Bruce Fitzhugh of that band that everybody listens to.
Yes.
How are we all doing, gentlemen?
Awesome.
Excellent.
Yeah.
I'm stoked. So let's set this up. I was delving around trying to think about some of the early music that I listened to, because that's what I like to talk to on this dumb show. And I thought, I never got a clear picture on whatever happened to REX, or I called it Rex until about 4 minutes ago when you called it REX. So I was like, I listened to a lot of bands on that label. I wonder whatever happened to that label. And I knew there was all kinds of stickiness with, like, it was a big deal when Sacrifice threw the first three albums up on Solid State. It was kind of like, I wonder how that all came to be. And I want to talk to Doug from REX. I wonder how that works. And Bruce was like, I know him. I'll get him. Can I come on the show? And I was like, yes, actually, you probably know more better questions to ask than I do. So I'm going to sit back, sip my tea, and I want to hear a little bit about Doug Mann and walk us through it.
with REX or the Bruce?
Well, dude. I mean, obviously, Travis, you have ideas and questions and. What happened here and how did you do this? But I mean, I honestly, these are things that I've never asked Doug or had the opportunity to ask him.
And you guys were on it.
What's that?
On REX.
Yeah. But I mean, it was very much a, you know, when he signed us, it was very much a, mentor, relationship where we had no clue what we were doing and we were just like, you know, whatever. So it wasn't like, although Doug was always super nice. Sorry. I don't know what's going on.
It's okay.
Yeah. Always super nice. It was never like, I just too young and dumb to ask him the types of things that I would ask somebody now, like Doug, what got you into music? And then what got you into metal, into such an extreme way to where you're like, I'm going to start a label and I'm going to sign Believer?
Yeah. Wow. Good question. Yeah. Very good question, Bruce. What got me into music? Well, you know, and Travis, you have my permission to use that family photo that I sent you guys because yeah, it might be my Christmas card this year. I don't know, you know? Okay. Yeah. But, yeah, my family, my dad loves it. He's 94 and loves it, you know, but that shows you that where this angst, a lot of family dynamics I won't delve into here. We don't have enough time.
Okay.
And we don't have a therapist as a co-host. So, nonetheless, yeah, the music side, I taught myself how to play guitar when I was 13, you know. Yes, I'm old enough to remember the Beatles and all that and vinyl. But I had this record player, this turntable that was really pretty cool. So I'd put on like the Beatles albums or Cream, you know, Clapton, Ginger Baker, Ed Bruce, you know.
Hell yeah, Ginger Baker.
Yeah. Powerhouses, all three of them, you know. I can't believe they didn't, you know, kill each other, but musical powerhouses. So it was just like, we lost Travis.
No, he's still there.
I'm adjusting my volume knob, but I thought it was a great idea to keep the interface 11 feet away. So I have to.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
I should be good now.
That's good. You have to rig like a coat hanger. Kind of like,
yeah, I'm so
I can get it.
I'm so stupid. I'm proof that anybody can do this. So anyway, go ahead. Where were you?
Yeah, Ginger Baker. Yeah, yeah. So, you know, so basically I would listen. I could slow down. You could adjust the speed. The belt drive and everything. And okay. So even put it in neutral and go backwards and everything. And so anyway, that's how I would study guitar riffs and everything like that. Mm-hmm. And listen to bass lines. And I eventually, it's crazy. And Bruce, you know what I'm saying here, and Travis, you probably do too, but it's like you can listen to a recording, especially if you're a fan, a music fan of an artist or a drummer, especially drums, like, you could listen to it and hear and probably guess very closely it was cut in that room because that room has this sound. It's kind of known for that. Or maybe it's the board. I don't know. But right. Probably the room. And then to even where you can hear like, you know, like I could even hear where the drummer is like, okay, is he moving around on the snare head? You know, or is he hitting it, popping it in the center? Is he consistent? And just, yeah, you know, that kind of stuff. Even as a 13, 14-year-old, I was noticing stuff like that. So I don't know why. I was just picking it up. And, yeah, so that got me into music. And then, of course, from there, it was like, actually, believe it or not, I played in an R&B band for a while. I used to have long blonde hair, and I froed it out.
You nice.
Know,
like Mitch Mitchell. You know.
Nice. What year was this?
Whew. This was 1973, probably 76. Yeah, I'm that old, guys. Yep.
how old are you?
Well, you look great.
Really?
Yeah.
I'll be 60 in March.
Psst, dude, I hope I look anywhere. No, never mind. Go ahead.
Yeah, 60 freaking.
I wouldn't have guessed. I wouldn't guess 60, and I don't know how to say that without sounding like I'm hitting on you. So
yeah, okay, yeah. Let's edit that out, please. No.
We're right past that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's great. So you were picking things out early on.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, at what point were you like, well, I want to be involved in that process? I mean, yeah. How did that come to light?
Well, you know, I just kind of, you know, from the whole R&B scene, I went into, then I started just listening to Sabbath, you know, of course, Hendrix and all the heavier stuff just at that time. And, you know, and then I was like, you know, I'm going to just start writing songs. And it was just, I think it, you know, growing up around Nashville, it was like at that time, it was like in the water. It's like, So what do you do? Well, I'm a songwriter, you know.
I forgot you grew up here.
Yeah.
See, because when I met you, you lived in Jersey.
Yeah.
Which is where the label was based.
That makes sense.
And you were a surfer.
Yes. Not a very good one, but
a Jersey surfer.
Yeah, there's such a thing amongst the hypodermic needles and such.
They have them.
Yeah. Right.
Wonderful.
Wildwood poisoning.
Yeah, Wildwood.
What part?
Reason it's called that.
So what part of Jersey?
I lived in Ocean City, like a couple blocks from the shore. So
right,
my typical day with REX, it sounds bad. Of course, I had no money per se.
I know.
Oh, now it's getting ugly. As it should.
Bruce is like, we're going to get to that.
I deserve that. Oh, gosh. Dude, that's awesome. Yeah, no, well, you know, so I took my rented surfboard. No, so I took my surfboard, but I'd go surfing in the mornings kind of thing, and come back and then work just ridiculous amounts of hours, of course, you know, when you're in a little startup by yourself doing sweat equity kind of thing. And, but I had these old vintage arcade machines too, so sometimes I would, my typical meal was like a pot of black coffee and a box of Pop-Tarts, like 12 of them, you know? Mm-hmm. And I don't know.
So were you like living by yourself when you started the label?
Oh, yeah. 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 Gotcha. Just this little cottage right by the sea. I mean, little. It was like two rooms.
How did you get from Nashville to Jersey? What was that transition? I imagine you went to college. I think you did. No, I'm not saying that bad. I don't necessarily recall, but it seems like you had a degree in something.
Well, yeah, I never finished because I wanted to go into music.
Gotcha.
But I went to Middle Tennessee State for recording industry management, RIM, the first year they ever started it. Man.
Nice. Wow.
And it was
insane.
Really awesome.
It's amazing that people still go to that school for that particular degree when it's not worth anything. I'm just kidding.
Well, no, it's true. Well, no, I would agree. Well, sorry, folks. You know, it's a...
I'm kidding.
Sorry to all you parents out there.
Kids ask me all the time, like, or not kids, but people are like, yeah, I'm in school for like... a recording business. I'm like,
and you're like, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
Like, why are you doing that?
Good. Cause I have 75 grand to piss away.
Here you go. Here's a better idea. Start a band and go on tour. And
yeah.
Learn way more.
Get a pirate version of Logic in your laptop and figure it out yourself.
Yeah. I'm kidding. I'm kidding. I know that there's people that have done really well with that degree. I just don't get it. So
yeah.
Anyways, okay. I digress because I like to throw in these little
that's awesome, man.
Funny, sarcastic aside. So
no, that's great.
Travis is loving it.
It's great. I was gonna drink my tea and sit back. This is fantastic.
So cool. So like you, what took you out of MTSU and that whole thing? How'd you get to Jersey?
How did I get to Jersey? Yeah, it's funny. It wasn't like, you know, from Nashville to Jersey. Well, I guess it was in some ways, but it's kind of like, I don't know if I shared this with you when we were at the custom shop at Gibson or not. I can't remember, dude. But basically, when I started the label, I was still in the Coast Guard. I was doing search and rescue. I spent 9 years.
I didn't know you're in the Coast Guard.
I didn't know that either.
Yeah, nobody knew how I started. And I started REX with a $1,200 credit union loan.
Cool.
Because you know what? I didn't know any better. And you know what? What really pushed the button? One, I didn't know any better that I couldn't do it, which was great.
Mm-hmm. That's always great.
It's a lot of freedom.
Yeah, and it should really encourage people who want to do this thing, you know, whether it's a band or a label or being a music publisher or have a podcast or whatever, you know, whatever that artistry looks like, you know, I think there's great freedom in that. So Yeah. So I think, you know, what really, one of the things that kind of spurred not just the idea, but it goes back to that angst as a youngster. And I still have a degree of that, obviously, doing Krav Maga and stuff like that. But that's another story later, I guess. But I worked at a little independent record label. And
what was it called?
What? Refuge Records.
Where was that located?
In Nashville, at Benson Company.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
No, I didn't know they had a record store. Or you said a label.
Label, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Sorry. Yeah. I thought you said record store. My bad.
No. But it's funny because I was leaving and that company and to go into the military and everything. So, but it was kind of like I remember the owner saying something to the effect of like, you know, that's okay. You'll never amount to anything. You know, you couldn't cut it, kind of this kind of thing. And I was just like, you know, which my initial reaction was like, yeah, maybe I should jump across that death. but you know, I didn't. So that's good.
That's weird.
Yeah.
I mean, you see people say that in movies and stuff all the time and tries to, you know, kind of build it up and whatever. But what year was that? Whew. When you left Refuge?
That was probably, I should have put a timeline together because I can't keep all the dates together in my head and everything.
Ballpark.
But it was probably 80s. 80s, yeah. Mid 80s, late 80s.
No, you know what? It was in this, had to be in the,
because you started REX in what year?
It actually 88? Late 89. I started it officially. And, Yeah, it was probably somewhere, probably late 70s, early 80s, I think. Probably early 80s. Okay. But, you know, I remember it because I was like, you know what? I'm going to show you one day.
Yeah.
Watch, you know? And so that was just one of the things that kind of spurred me on. And there wasn't the compelling reason to do it. But really, it was for REX, you know. So I took this loan out, and what I did was I heard about this band called Triton out of Chicago, out of Illinois, Larry Dean. And they had these masters looking to do something with them. And I was like, you know what? Let's do a license deal. Like, let's just do a 3-year deal. I was really upfront with everybody. Like, you know, this is just getting going and everything. And like, you know, and, So I put it out there. I moved out of the barracks. Okay. I got a little apartment. I put a map of the United States on the wall by the phone and, you know, marked it off by time zone. And then I was like, okay, so we have a record. So I need to get this designed. I know this guy, Jeff Spencer, who does graphic design work. And really good designer. And so I'll ask Jeff if he can do this. And I want to learn how to design at the same time. Mm-hmm. Because to me, it's like, I may not know everything. I certainly don't. As you all know, Bruce. But try to surround yourself with successful people more knowledgeable, and try to glean from them and contribute but learn. Contribute but learn. And,
sure.
And that's just what you take through life. So... I did everything. I called Heaven's Metal, talked to Doug Van Pelt about getting coverage, you know, didn't know Doug, just picked up the phone, called, important distribution, mainstream distributor at the time. And, I would call Christian bookstores and they're like, yeah, sorry, we don't carry that kind of stuff, son. You know?
Yeah.
Or we sell it, but we sell it under the shelf, under the counter. The kids have to ask for it, which I thought, great.
Really? Christian bookstores were selling non-Christian stuff, but it was like bottom shelf liquor?
No. They wouldn't, like, I remember, like, Extraction from Mortality and Living Sacrifice and Sacrifice.
Oh, like the extreme stuff had to be.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You know, at the time.
That, right.
Yeah. Right. So they, it was kind of funny. So I don't know, but.
How did you meet Kurt and Joey from Believer, and how did that whole thing come out?
Yeah, you know, I think, you know,
Hold on. Yeah. Can I ask you a couple questions here? You said you got started around 89. I looked up REX on Wikipedia.
Yeah.
So all this might be wrong. It says operated. It is. Okay. It says operated.
Because I looked at it too.
Okay. Operated late 87. And then it said you founded it with someone named Gavin Morkel.
He was a silent partner, and eventually he came in because he was a business operations finance guy.
Got it. Okay.
And I wasn't.
Got it. Okay. And I was just wondering. I wonder.
Doug's an art guy.
Art guy. Got it.
Okay. Yeah. Doug was busy finding the talent.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, you know, and that's the thing. Yeah.
Which is true. I'm not making a joke. I'm not being facetious here.
No. Well, and once you have a Believer, a Living Sacrifice, the lead hardcore punk, you know, Christian band, fantastic artist, you don't have to go out and look for talent at that point.
Well, here's the thing, Doug, you were into that stuff. Or you saw art in that stuff.
Absolutely.
Before anybody else did, probably, in the, you know, bands like The Lead and and I can't imagine even Believer. And that's why I was asking you. I mean, you're older. You come from a 60s, 70s background musically.
Oh yeah.
So it's like, how do you make that leap from
good question.
That type of music into like extreme punk and metal,
right?
Because that's what you did, and you did it before anybody else. I mean, a lot of credit has been, you know, put onto, you know, Brandon Ebel and Tooth and Nail for popularizing, you know, a lot of Christian music, you know, within lots of different genres and
and
quote unquote, you know, making it cool, which he did, but I know for a fact that he met with you before he ever started his label.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause I actually saw him at GMA I don't even know if it still exists.
He worked for a distribution company, I believe.
Yeah.
Something tied to
Frontline Music, or Diamante or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Something like that. I can't remember.
I thought he mentioned that in the Tooth and Nail documentary, that I think he got a job at Frontline and then started to right?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So yeah, but I remember at the trade show, like Brandon and a couple of his friends came up and he's like, "You're Doug, man, you're Doug. Oh my God, you're Doug, man." You know, and I was like I was like, "Oh, are you having a go at me? Like what seriously?" Like and he was just like, "Wow, I grew up on your music." And you know, of course I'm relatively young then compared to now, and I'm like going, "I'm not that old." It's like, you know, but it was really funny. And then I realized later he was really sincere. Like,
yeah, totally.
And absolutely. So then we would meet now and again. And then when it came down to when he started Tooth and Nail, he was looking for distribution. Of course, everybody was courting him. And, it's like, I think at the time I was at Forefront. We had gone over to Forefront, and I remember Dan Brock, Eddie DeGarmo saying, "Yeah, you know, you were probably 7 years too early with REX music." You know,
well,
I should have been second to the game, is what they said. And I was like, "Yeah, thanks. Another near miss."
Well, yeah, dude.
Oh well.
Aren't we all? I mean,
we made some great art together, though. All of us.
Yeah, exactly. No, I think it's awesome, and I mean, I think that it should be. And people that don't maybe do or don't know, it's like those early albums. I mean, I'm definitely not talking about my band, but like there weren't a lot of options for a band like Living Sacrifice, but like with the other stuff that you had out there, like specifically the lead and Believer, and especially Believer, because that's how we were introduced to you, is we sent our demos directly to them. And everything. But then, you know, Circle of Dust and Scott Albert and finding his music.
Amazing.
Who else did you sign early on that you're really, really happy about? Because
I would say, you know, I would include Sacrament in there.
Sacrament?
Yeah.
I just love the heaviness. And then, you know, let's see, who else? Yeah, it was funny. I was looking at Wikipedia. Actually, I printed it out. And by the way, just so they can correct this, following the label's closure, founder Doug Mann took a position on Forefront Records. This is like the closure. I'm like going, when did it close? 97. There was all these. I didn't even know all these law things. Like, seriously. And I'm like going, no, I left in April of 93. Just
well, they don't go in and change it. That's the whole thing with Wiki. You have to go in and change it.
Oh, really? Oh, okay, cool. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah. I mean, you're
a lot of good that did. Okay.
Yeah. So, Travis, Doug's tenure at the label only lasted 2 years for us. Like while we were there, our third album came out and Doug was gone. He was out of there.
Did they ever say anything about when he left, why he left? Or I didn't get to, you know, there's a reason I couldn't even talk to the artist. I had to sign an agreement.
Oh, you got to tell us how that went down, because that sounds like some secret, you know.
We are all over the place here, but we definitely want to get down there.
All over the place.
It's all right, whatever.
Well, not really. They were just like, oh yeah, Doug's left the label. He's going to another label or something. But we didn't talk to you, and maybe we couldn't. I don't know. And I was just like, oh, you know, now you deal with Tyler Bacon. And we're like, okay,
cool. Yeah,
and whatever.
Tyler was a great guy. Is a great guy.
He was, but we were a headache to him and a thorn probably on his side. I mean, we were like, at some
point, an artist. Come on, yeah.
Yeah, we were not, we were just, I mean, we were kind of dumb kids, but also we were just like, you don't get it, man.
Don't you understand our art?
Yeah, anyways, he worked really hard. I'll definitely say that. And I know he's done really well, but back to you, Doug. So you started the label. How did you find the Believer guys?
Yeah, that's, you know what, we probably need to call a friend, like one of those game show hosts, because I cannot remember the first time I met Joey and Kurt. You know, it's like,
how did you hear their music?
Yeah,
a demo.
Well, a demo. Yeah.
That's how, because that's how we got in touch with them too.
Yeah. And I'm sure, you know, what I did was. You know, I took that map also, and from an A&R perspective, I'm one person. I'm trying to do A&R. I'm trying to, you know, learn to cut my teeth producing records, market, sell, radio promotion. It was just insane. It was just stupid, you know, like, what was I thinking? You know, you need a team of people. So what I did was I created hubs around the U.S., one person, kind of like what you do with a street team now, you know, or mm-hmm. maybe not launch teams, whatever. And if they hear of any bands, then I would either get the cassette tape back then or go and try and see them play live without knowing that I was there.
Did you subscribe to any of those zines that were out there? The ones like that Burrito was putting out and,
I got a ton of stuff in the post, all the black and white underground mags and everything, I can't remember all the names, you know, at this point, but So Believer, I mean, it's like when you hear their music, and it's like you guys too, Bruce, you know, you hear the music recorded and then you meet them and then you certainly see them live and you just go, oh my gosh, we have to work with these guys, you know? I mean, this art needs to be heard, you know, needs to be seen, experienced, and tremendous artistry. I don't know. That's the early days, you know.
Were you into metal at that time?
Were you like that
form of like European metal, or was it just the guys that kind of like brought you into that world?
No, I would have to give credit to the guys in many ways for me bringing me, you know, or expanding that for me.
Yeah.
One thing I did with REX early on too was to study. Sorry, the feedback. Woohoo! But what I did early on with REX, I would try to study the underground European music scene. Because I was convinced outside of everything like techno, you know, EDM, would eventually make its way to the shores of the States.
Mm-hmm.
And so I felt like, and certainly I felt like hard rock, progressive metal would always be around, you know, in some shape, form, or fashion. I really didn't believe that, and as it is today. And so I just grew to love it because I think it just fed, you know, the angst that, you know, I don't know. It just there's a passion to it and that intensity. And it's just that release that just that, you know what I'm talking about. Just like,
Well, yeah, but I mean, I grew up on it, and like you know, for myself, you know, I mean, I got into, I mean, Van Halen changed my life in 1979, and I was only, I was teeny tiny or whatever, and then I was into that form of metal up until about 85 when I heard Metallica, and then it all changed again for me.
Yeah. So. Well, and yeah, Metallica certainly big influence, and you know, I had a friend that was friends with guitarist with Kurt, and so you know, be on Will Call in a couple of cities, and so just go out and hang out with them and see the shows live and everything. So
that's cool.
Yeah, it was fun.
So you saw him in the early mid 80s then, huh?
Oh yeah.
Nice. Yep.
Wow. Yeah. And Justice for All tour, that was a fun one. And that's the only time you know, I've kept like all memorabilia, like the backstage pass and stuff and everything like that. I wish I didn't even get to leave REX Music with any records. I have no, you know, no CDs, no vinyl, no 8-tracks.
you need copies of anything? I have tons of stuff.
Yeah, it'd be great, man. I'm like going, wow, it's like that's how out of touch I've been with. And this is, and like I told Travis, I said, this will be the first and last interview I ever do about REX Music. Not because it's painful. It's just like, you know, I mean, my gosh, I think we've all kind of moved on, or at least I have. I mean, I'm kind of like, well, oh, well, you know, I put this, you know, sweat equity into this baby that I really loved, and I wanted to keep it a small, you know, a roster of artists to develop them and not expand it and sign anything that had a pulse, you know?
Right.
Which I think just really is a detriment to the brand overall, and whatever company does that. So, anyway.
So, okay. So when you say, when you make a statement like that, like, this is the first and last interview, and I couldn't talk about it for a while.
Right.
I've never heard. I don't think I've ever heard that situation. I'm not saying they don't exist. I'm just saying me personally, just the dummy that on the other side of the counter that buys this stuff. I've never heard of the situation where someone left a label and wasn't allowed to talk about it. And I think that there was situations with Believer getting their albums cut loose from that tangle. I know
well done to them. I don't know how that, I have no clue.
And Bruce, maybe you can speak a little bit to how self-titled Inhabit, non-existent and Inhabit got out of that too. I mean, I just don't know what happened, and I'm curious if you could kind of get into it a little bit as to why it was so like, Doug's not there anymore. No one talks about it. We don't talk about that anymore. We just move on.
Yeah. Why was it so secret, Doug, when you left?
Yeah. You know, I'm not sure.
I'm sure the statute of limitations are up, bro.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
20 years.
Yeah. It has been that long, hasn't it?
Yeah.
It's just like, you know, it's kind of like what happened was you have two business partners, okay, and my vision, like I said, was to keep a small roster of artists, develop them over time, and not that you wouldn't expand that, but you keep it within, you know, reason, and so you could focus more on developing artistry and what they're about and everything.
I like that. That's good.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it makes sense.
It isn't about growth and getting bigger and bigger and taking over. It's about like really, really nourishing what you already have. You know,
yeah.
After you left, I mean, obviously, it was really plain and clear that they just started signing everything under the sun, and there was no focus. And it was like, oh, we're going to sign a blues band, and now we're going to sign a pop band, and
yeah,
I mean, they actually. Got lucky with a few, like Sixpence and I don't know if you were involved with that, but Sixpence and Fleming and John and things like that. But
I signed Sixpence.
Oh, good. There you go.
Yeah. And, you know, and then And right after that, it was like, it was before they were supposed to make their record when I needed to leave.
Yeah.
And what happened was, you know, it goes back to, you have this leadership that, you know, I'm focusing on art, and then you have the other, you know, Gavin, you know, who is a really good guy, a business guy, operations, finance, which I don't know that, didn't know that much about. I do now, not about REX, but the industry and music and just business in general. But so of course you're going to have maybe not, we weren't on parallel tracks even, you know?
Yeah, yeah. No, it's really hard when you're, yeah, you know, in a partnership with somebody, especially a silent partner who comes in and decides, oh, well, I like music too. So, you know, we should sign such and such and do this and do that. Yeah.
Yeah. And the whole goal was to increase revenue and to make a lot of money and hopefully retire early, which, you know what, that's great. You know, I mean, fantastic. There's nothing wrong with making money or wanting to retire.
Sure.
You know? I mean,
but you saw the writing on the wall really fast.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I always thought I was a slow learner, Bruce. I don't know, man.
I'm just fascinated that we started off this conversation by saying that Doug Mann started REX Records, and then you keep referring to they, when I left, they did this, they did that. When did this flourish into beyond Doug Mann and turned into a they thing?
Yeah. Well, my business partner, I mean, basically it was just two different visions, and it was just like one day I was like, you know, I don't recognize the label that I had envisioned that I was part of founding and really leading it in the very, very early days and shaping its DNA in a sense. Now, I had the vision for that and casting it, but, you know, I mean, at the same time, it's like a record label executive, if you want to call it that, can't make the label. You can brand it, you can market it, you can position it, but it's the artists that you work with that define it. So the credit really does go to them. And I mean that in all sincerity. So, but it was like one day it's like I woke up and just went, you know, I just don't recognize this company anymore. It's like, it's signing artists that I just, you know, no. And there were just a lot of other stuff going on. So, you know, and it was kind of like, and we're making records. It's like, I remember Bruce, I think it was the third Living Sacrifice record in Nashville.
The second one. Yeah.
Was it the second one?
Yeah.
Non-existent. Yeah. Really? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh man. And I was there, but it was like all this other stuff going on in the background, business stuff was a major distraction.
Yeah. Yeah. And we didn't know anything about all that stuff. I mean, it was,
yeah, because
we were just, yeah.
Yeah, because you want artists to do what they're best at, focus on art, right?
Yeah, of course. I mean, yeah, you should. Right, I mean, we were kids. So you know, it's not something we needed to know about. I want to say, you know, I mean, I feel like though, like for us, I mean, we recorded the first record in 91 and that second one just 1 year later in 92. And it was really quick. We did the first record with you and Kurt, and the second record with you up here in Nashville, and then an engineer. And
he's doing some great country records now, I hear. I'm just kidding. Oh, sorry. I know we both want to go there, but I'm sorry.
I won't say anything except for I think we found out through the process that he was being paid an hourly rate. And that his main credit was
being paid. Oh my God.
Assistant. second or third assistant on a, on a, what was it? An Amy Grant record, maybe something like that. I don't know. We were explaining to him the mechanics and the concept of heavy metal to the guy.
I remember that. That was where it was like, you know, something has really gone awry here.
Yeah. Anyways, well,
which don't let me forget that, because that's a key point and why, another reason why, because the studio.
We'll go into it. I mean, what was happening? I obviously, well,
was,
all happening during that time.
The early days, we were recording in Philly at Morningstar with Believer. It was great. Just awesome stuff. And just, or it was licensed like Lead. They were doing their stuff in Miami, you know. And they were incredible to work with too. And so, but then as things kind of, it's kind of like driving down the highway and somebody forgot to tighten the lug nuts on the wheels of the car. And it's kind of like, you're wobbling. You're like going, hey, is that my tie? No. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You know? And so it was kind of like, then it was like, well, no, you need to use this engineer and go to this studio. And, you know, and so I'm like, you know, but, you know, I worked with Paul Kruger and now, yeah, his engineering, you know, is probably, I listened to those recordings, you know, not now, but many, many years ago. And I was like going, wow, that's really wet. That is not dry enough and heavy and powerful enough. But anyway, whatever. Yeah. I guess we all have 2020 hindsight. But yeah, it's, and so it, that frustration actually, and you could ask Scott Albert, or I think he goes by Clay now.
Clay, of course, yeah, we need to call
and,
him.
You know, we were in Chicago or Elgin, Illinois, and recording Circle of Dust. And it was so funny at this. It was the old Masonic Lodge.
Yeah, Wonderland.
Oh, is that? That's it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. They actually use that as a venue, the ballroom.
Yeah.
Which we played multiple times.
Really?
Years. Yeah. But my first visit there, I feel like there was a band recording there, Dig Jesus.
Oh, yeah.
Or Hot. And we just happened to be in Chicago on tour, or maybe it was Hot Pink Turtle. It was one of those bands, and we toured the studio and the place or whatever. So it was pretty neat. Wow. And then later on, years later, we ended up playing the ballroom and everything. It was a great place to play. I mean, there were always tons of kids there. Anyways,
wow, go ahead.
But
this is awesome. This is awesome. You're like you know, pulling me out of my dementia. This is great, Bruce.
Dude, I'm the worst. I have a terrible memory. If we had DJ on this podcast, oh my gosh, that guy would just, I mean, he'd be pulling out actual flyers and stuff.
Don't get me started on Darren Johnson, the guy who he gets into a text thread with you, and then I'm like, I literally texted him, now don't you do this to me. You always text me back, and then you disappear for weeks. He's like, not this time. Dude, that was weeks ago. I don't know if he just keeps dropping his phones in puddles, or I don't know what his deal is, but he disappears for long periods and he comes back.
He's a mysterious man.
I'm gonna reel him in. Bruce, I need your help. Go tackle him at the ankles, man.
Okay, so
anyway,
so I
oh, let me finish the Wonderland story.
Yeah.
Okay,
so check it out. So I think it was on Circle of Dust or Brainchild when Scott and I did Brainchild Mind Warp together, because we wrote the songs and recorded that and everything, which is really that's a funny story too. In Nashville, I think it was Omni Studios. We're in room B, and in room A was Point of Grace doing their first record. Okay.
Perfect. I'm sitting one block from that studio right now. Just so
you know. Are you?
Yeah.
That's great. Well, and so Scott, and I, so we wrote, we called it, what was it? Something about, what was it? The Sphere Room or something. And so we wrote Fear Room because they were like, wow, what kind of music are you guys doing in there? We're like, yeah, Fear Room B. That sounds great. And, you know, and so, yeah, but anyway, so there's a logo. I don't know if it's still there, but it has this logo of this guy eating a donut and has a chair, and it's called Psycho Boy. Ah, you know, and he's doing this. And and that came from Scott and the incident at that studio in Chicago or Elgin there, Wonderland. So the engineer that we had, I can't remember the guy's name. Poor guy. He must have come out of, like, you know, the rim course or something, you know, and working with the two of us. And so Scott and I are like, okay, we're going to take a break. We're going to go grab a coffee or something. Want anything, you know, bite to eat or whatever. We'll be back. You go ahead and just work on that and come back. We just wanted to, you know, let our ears rest and everything. So we come back, you know, sit down. And I remember Scott is on the couch in the back. I'm sitting there, you know, at the console with the engineer and, you know, listening, you know, and I'm like, and I said, well, stop that. Wait, whoa, go back. And he's like, oh, rewinds and plays it through. And I said, stop. I said, that vocal is not even remotely close. Like, it was like so off pitch. It was like almost in the wrong key, kind of. It wasn't a performance. It was just like, you know, like, and I said, you know, as an audio guy, what do you think of that? Are you willing to let that go? And he's like, well, it has its moments. I snapped. All I did was I stood up, turned around, I picked up the chair, and I threw it across the room, and Scott was like,
nice.
And the guy was like, yeah, I was like, I think we better take a break.
So was this somebody that Gavin had hired?
Yeah.
To engineer the record?
Yes.
I don't. So how did he come
in? Awesome.
It's amazing. Yeah.
I got a logo out of it.
But how did you come in or how did Gavin come in and start? How did the business guy start getting his hands into the creative?
Yes. Yes. When did Doug Mann and Silent Partner become a they that Doug needed to leave? Like they had to have gained momentum and
well, no, I mean, Doug, why? I mean, the guy comes, I mean, I'm sure he's a good guy, but I mean, oh, yeah. I mean, were you not,
well, when
he says, hey, let's use this engineer, were you not like, no, let's not use that engineer. He's never done anything like this. Right. We need somebody that understands this style of music.
Yeah. You know, it's two things I'll put it down to is probably my trying to find my way as I go, just young and dumb. Well, not that young, but dumb. You know, inexperience and a lot of times, you know, and the perception was, here's this person who has worked in the music industry for a long time, far longer than me, and that I, not necessarily maybe looked up to, but I certainly respected him, you know, and
who's this Gavin?
Yeah, yeah.
So he was in the music industry?
Yeah, he had been in the music industry before and distribution and so.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
And, yeah, so and then, you know, and of course he controlled the checkbook. So you know,
a lot of power there.
Yeah, so and I probably should have, and now I'd be like going, oh no. We're not doing things that way. We're not playing that game now. You know. But then it was like, yeah.
No, I get it.
You know, we get a little wiser through experience and
totally.
And unfortunately it's, you know, it doesn't end well all the time. I don't know. It ended okay for me. I don't know. You know, I'm happy with what we did in the early years. You know, it's so funny. I even ran into some people. This is like 10 years ago or something at one of the conventions, trade shows. And they were like, oh, you're Doug Mann. Yeah, we own the REX Masters. And I was like, cool. I didn't know they'd been sold. That's congratulating. Okay.
Yeah. Probably been sold a couple times.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, so... Yeah. So, I mean, basically, so what really transpired? So all of that, you take that kind of that inexperience or I don't know, not, I don't know what I just said, you know, that just, you know, the finances, et cetera, and just, and you start looking at it, it's like that, it's kind of like that defining moment where you just kind of go, wow, I don't recognize this label, you know,
yeah.
anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so I went to him and I just said, you know, I said, I, you know, things have got to, we, it has to change, you know, and obviously it wasn't going to. So it was just kind of like, well, it's time for me to go. You know, I just said, you know, I can't do this like this anymore. And I think, you know, he was surprised by that, but, so, you know, and, you know, but it's kind of like with all the dynamics and everything, it's like, how can you even focus on art? It's not fair to the artist. It's not fair to the label. It's not fair to me. You know, not that it was all about me, but you know, sure. You got to take care of yourself to some degree.
Totally. So, when you started at Forefront, what was that like? Did you like it right away? Or was it kind of like, oh, this is weird because it's way more CCM or? What was that like?
Yeah, that was. It wasn't weird. It was very different in the sense of they had never had a director of A&R before. And I think there was like five or six other people, including the owner. Yeah. And they had a silent partner, Eddie DeGarmo. Dan Brock was like the president of the company. Great guy, both of them. Awesome. Learned so much from those guys. Oh, my gosh. You know, how a real record label should be run, you know?
Yeah.
101.
Who did you sign at Forefront?
Yeah, let's see. Well, you know, really it was signings. I'd have to go back and think through. You guys might be able to Google that while I ramble incoherently.
I'm on it.
But, you know, it was more like developing artists. They had a little known band.
So who was on their roster?
DC Talk,
yeah,
which had just come out with New Thang. Yeah, so I love the way it was spelled. You
know? Travis, was that your favorite DC Talk record?
down with the DC Talk.
Well, my mother always said, if you've got nothing good to say about bands that you don't like, no, I'm good. Oh, moving on.
Man, ouch.
Stuff sucked, dude. I said it. That stuff was terrible.
Oh, the first, it wasn't the best. That new thing wasn't the best.
I mean, even the good stuff that everybody loved, I was the one listening to it going,
yeah. Really?
But then again, I like Queensryche. Yeah. What the hell do I know, you know?
That's a good point.
Well, I definitely want to hear about your involvement in releasing the biggest Christian rock album of all time.
Oh, nice setup.
Which one? Was that Non-Existent?
Lame.
Oh, lame. I'm laughing my ass off. What are you talking about?
That's a good record, dude.
What? No. I mean, sales wise, what that thing sold? Yeah. 20 million copies.
Yeah. It's okay.
What?
Jesus freak,
right?
Yeah. I did A&R on that. And then that was my first record, as VP of marketing. And you know how I got VP of marketing?
That's DC Talk, right?
Yeah. So I do the A&R in the studio and everything. And I remember standing there at the console and Toby was like, hey, just, you know, they just recorded the intro, you know, Mark Heimerman and the guys were there and just recorded the intro to, you know, the little squashed on a cassette player, compressed sound before it opened up. And, so he just pulls up the faders and he goes, I just want to let you listen to this track and see what you think. You know, because your history musically, I was like, okay. And so we're standing there. And so I hear Jesus Freak, you know, coming out through those NS10s, Yamaha, and through the other speakers. I'm like, yeah, you know, I was like, it was surprising for DC Talk. I mean, admittedly.
Well, yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, they took a complete turn. I mean, I don't know much about them. I remember they were a rap group at first.
Right.
And then they put out this rock record that was,
yeah.
I mean, for all intents and purposes, very well produced.
Absolutely.
It sounded good. Yeah. And I remember hearing it thinking for the first time and thinking, oh, they're like, they've taken this turn into rock and they're kind of like trying to be a little edgy and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Obviously, those songs struck a chord with, you know, a lot of people. It wasn't my thing, you know, or anything like that. But yeah, I mean, how did you react when you first heard it? You were like, oh, so you guys aren't rapping anymore or what?
No, it's funny because I remember like the song stopped and I was just silent and I was just kind of looking at the board. And Toby goes, what do you think? And I was like, and you know, just real deadpan serious. I was just like, yeah, you know, I think your career is over. Yeah.
Wow.
And he's like, really? I was like, nah, just kidding, man. It's awesome. And we laughed and, you know, he probably is like, that beep, you know, I'll self edit myself, Travis.
I don't give a shit.
I mean, I'll say this about it. Like I've probably never even heard the entire record all the way through. I've just heard bits and pieces of it, but, whoever's vision that was, and I assume it was Toby's. Totally. I mean, good on him.
Brilliant. You know? Toby's
for taking his band that could have gone off into obscurity as kind of a joke.
Gotcha.
For the type of stuff that they were doing previous to that record into like
20 million albums.
Yeah. I mean,
I can respect that.
Yeah.
And on top of that, calling it Jesus Freak.
Well, yeah.
Ballsy.
Yes. Huge balls. Hey, I have nothing but respect for Toby, but I don't know him personally, but I know lots of people that work for him and everything, and he's super well respected. So
yeah, no, he's the real deal. I mean, he is, I think, the perfect makeup of like a business person and an artist, and he's really, you know, and Forefront, Dan Brock and those guys had a lot to do with that, mm-hmm. With Goatee and helping that along, that process. But, you know, all credit to Toby and those guys, man, they, you know, it's amazing and really, you know, had some great experiences working with them. And, you know, and two things, my favorite song off of that album is What Have We Become? You know, I love that, you know?
Yeah.
So still timely, I think. I think I took from REX, and that was my whole approach to artist and repertoire, artist development. Because you meet A&R people from labels. I don't know if it's still this way now, but I would meet some who want to live vicariously through artists.
Yeah. Sure.
And I just think that's wrong. And now, do artists and songwriters need guidance and this and that? Yeah, you know, sure. But at the end of the day, it's like when you have an artist like a DC Talk, like Believer, you know, the lead, Living Sacrifice. I mean, you guys, you know who you are as an artist. And so, you know what? You need to let them kind of expand those little orange cones, those boundaries of imagination and creativity, and express their art. So, and that was fun to do that with them. Now, some of the other artists on the label needed to do a lot more or a little more.
Who else are you proud of working with or releasing wise with Forefront?
Oh gosh, with Forefront. Oh man, Iona. I loved Iona.
Yeah. You guys
never heard of him or.
I remember her, yeah. Or it's a female singer, right?
Yeah.
I remember her. I haven't listened in years, but yeah.
Yeah, they were just amazing players, and I think they were far better live than they were on their studio albums.
Mm. Iona is the band from
yes,
from
Europe.
Europe, but.
UK, Ireland.
Ireland. Yes, I've seen Wales. Them a lot. You had something to do with signing them?
Well, no, I didn't sign them. No, just keeping them on the roster and developing them. And so I worked on really hard on the record Beyond These Shores. And then I was able to get them to come over and play like a Creation festival. I think they played Cornerstone. And they were great to work with.
I just saw them. I saw them recently. Probably really? Within, not recently this week. recently within the past 6-7 years.
Wow.
They played a Sellersville theater, probably about half hour north of Morningstar. And I thought, wow, this is one of these sit down shows where you can kind of relax and take it in. It isn't like I'm getting elbowed in the mouth at some hardcore show or whatever, you know. And it was fantastic. Fantastic. Beautiful music.
It's great. That's funny. One of my favorite bands I like, one of the best live bands I've ever seen that I've never worked with is the Gypsy Punks. Gogo Bordello. You guys ever hear of them?
I have not.
I've heard of Gogo Bordello, not Gypsy Punks, though.
Oh, it's the same. Yeah. If you get to see them live, you need to go. Might not be your cup of tea, but dude,
how did you go? That's kind of a good segue into how did you went to Ireland for many years?
Yeah.
And that was obviously after your Forefront tenure. How long were you at Forefront?
Oh gosh, let's see. 93 through 98. And I was director of artists and repertoire starting off, and then when EMI bought them, and they, you know, and that's why I became VP of marketing, because it was like they kept hiring a VP of marketing every 6 months and then firing him or her. And so I actually suggested, of course, in a meeting in front of, you know, it's kind of like speaking before thinking, you know. You guys should just, why don't you just put a revolving door in the back instead of a back door at the exit and just keep spinning it, man.
You know, Were you the only guy saying stuff like this at the label?
Yeah. I went to Ireland. I sat in one meeting and I said, you know, what are we doing here? And they're like, what do you mean? I'm like, well, you know, I mean, are we just evangelizing to evangelize or what? I mean, we're not moving beyond the walls of this Christian community. Like, and it was like, finally, one of the executives like, look, and just deadlock right in the eyes. If you don't believe in what we're doing here, then maybe you should leave. And I was like, I fell back in my big cushy leather chair and I went, thanks. You might be right. And, you know, and I remember seeing Eddie DeGarmo over there and a couple other people. And it was like that Jerry Maguire moment. He was just like, your career longevity just went down the, you know. So I wound up leaving, actually. So, and going to Ireland. Yeah. Of all places.
At that point at the label, I mean, were you feeling like, we're just preaching to the choir type thing?
Well, I just wondered, you know, and
because in that business early on, obviously, I understand like the business grew out of necessity. A lot of these artists in the 70s were not being looked at by any type of major label or record label at all. So they created their own. Good on them.
Yeah, Stonehill, Norman.
Yeah, absolutely. You
know, Keith Green, amazing.
Absolutely.
Influenced my life.
And then almost
as much as Brendan Manning did, you know?
Right. And then, but at some point, I don't know if it was in the 80s or probably, it turned into a business.
Yeah.
And how do you have business and ministry in the same thing? Because they don't go together.
Yeah, it's kind of tough. It's kind of like oil and water, isn't it, to some degree?
Great question, Bruce. Because I suffer this affliction all the time. I always have this itchiness in my brain when I feel like this kind of turns into the whole like plumber with the Jesus fish on his card thing, where I kind of feel like, why are you mixing the two together? Why does this have anything to do with anything? Like, just go out there and play shows. I don't see why this has to be a Christian label, Christian scene, churches. Yeah. Christian.
Right, but again, I feel like it started from probably a sincere place.
I agree. These people
wanted to put out their own records, but at some point, it became an industry unto itself that was only distributing to bookstores.
Right,
and you know,
or mail order.
Yeah, yeah, and so, So, Doug, you know, how, I mean, was that an itch in your crawl, or you know, it sounds like it was based on what you're saying.
Well, I do want to go on record and say I'm not old enough to remember mail order, so thank goodness. you know, it must have been to some degree. You know, I don't think it was as clear cut in my mind or my heart. It was kind of like it was just that conflict. This like, you know, like you go to the shows and you see the kids and they're screaming and it's great. They're celebrating and everything great. But it's kind of like, you know, then you talk to people outside of the church and Christian culture, even in Europe, Western or Eastern Europe, and they're like, contemporary Christian music? What is that?
Dude, I did it. I got into Believer.
Yeah.
Tourniquet.
Oh, Tourniquet, yeah.
LS, right around the same time as Anthrax, Megadeth, Metallica. So I was the idiot who was working at an amusement park going, yeah, that stuff's cool. I listen to that too. Have you ever heard of Psychosurgery from Tourniquet? Have you ever heard Non-Existent? And they're like, who? 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 And I'm like, this is like Christian stuff. And they're like, what? What does that even mean? No one had, and I was like, this is a whole thing. Exactly. Like I was the one championing it. Like, this is a whole thing. This is an entire, like, I didn't just make this tape up. Like I bought this for this. This is a product that I purchased from a band that's playing out somewhere tonight. This stuff exists. Like this is a real thing. And people were like, it's not legitimate. And I'm like, it is legitimate. I'm holding it. It's in my Walkman. What's wrong with you? You know? And do you want to borrow it? And you want me to copy it for you? And I would start swapping with people like,
yeah,
you know, I need Among the Living. Make me a copy of that. And I'll rip you Extraction from Mortality or something. And I was the one that was kind of like trying to push that stuff out. It was out there. It was legitimate, but it never, not it never. That's not fair. I think this stuff did. You know, Believer went out with Bolt Thrower and Sacrifice. Not
well, Believer got picked up by Roadrunner. I mean,
right?
I was around for that. That was
awesome. The early artists. Yeah, these are the early artists that started. You know, the crossover, and then you know later on, obviously, MXPX and Under Oath and Zayo and all
you
that.
One of my favorite forefront moments though was involved Living Sacrifice, Bruce.
Oh, great.
A forefront moment with Living Sacrifice?
Yes. Oh, it was great. So I'm in the meeting.
Was it when they covered Jesus Freak?
Did you guys? Really?
No. No.
Maybe you should. No. You know what you should do? You guys, you should do like just a record of songs you never want to ever record or be known for or something, you know, and just like, whether it's Christian or not, just and make them good, you know, like maybe not. Okay. The forefront story was funny. So, you know, so I'm in this, you know, meeting with the president and other people. And so at the, you know, at the end of this meeting, I can't remember what it was for. It was probably had to do with marketing and blah, blah, blah. And just kind of a round table thing. And it was when Forefront was small. It was like, I was director of artists and repertoire. So, you know, one of the Christian retail magazines had this whole article. I don't know if it was a 2-page spread. It might have been, actually. Anyway, about, you know, just how awful these covers from some of these bands are. And the hero product that was featured was Non-Existent from Living Sacrifice and that REX Music label. And so it was cool because the president of the company goes, he's like, look at this. What kind of sicko thinks of that? Like, you know, what, look at it, you know, is that like, seriously, you know, it's just kind of like, you know, like what's this industry kind of coming to kind of thing.
Well, tell him that you were involved in the album and the artwork and everything?
Yeah. I smiled and I just said, I said, I said, yeah, actually, you know, I worked with the band and everything, and, you know, did that album cover and that album before I left REX. And he was like, oh, you know, and I'm thinking in my mind, like, well, that's what some of us refer to even now as reality, that cover, you know, and so he's like, oh, well, okay. Yeah. And so awkward moment. So I go back to my office. So the next day I go home and I dig out my, remember the long sleeve, non-existent black t-shirt?
Yeah, totally.
I wear it into Forefront the next day.
With the album cover on the front.
Yeah.
Perfect.
And people were like, you know, it's got the pile of skulls behind you guys. And people were like, oh, you know, like, I hope he doesn't have too many meetings today. You know,
make so it work down in the mail room today.
You love it. Yeah, you love it.
It was kind of fun.
Guys, I hate to do it, man. I got to jump off though here soon.
That's okay. But, Bruce, thanks for joining. You can hop off, Doug. You stay on a little bit.
Yeah. I can stay on.
Yeah. Right. Keep going and talk about Ireland. I want to hear about that.
Yeah. Okay.
We'll talk about Ireland. We'll talk about non-existent and the disgusting artwork.
All right, awesome. Bruce. It's good to see you, man, and hear you. Yeah.
You too. Let's talk soon and come see me in Nashville.
I would love to do it.
All right. See you. Thank you so much, Travis, for letting me be a part of it.
You're welcome, dude. Thanks for hopping in and helping out.
Heck yeah.
Don't make me use this. One step closer, I'm warning you.
Later.
See you, man.
He's shot. Guy shot.
We love you. Take care. Bye-bye.